if you'd look, just to kind of give you some perspective, top right-hand corner over here, you look at the little black lines inside where the prophets are, you can see that the first of the prophets mentioned is Elijah. Elijah doesn't write, well, I shouldn't say he doesn't write, but he didn't write anything that's recorded down as a major statement. We do have some brief things that were stated that are recorded within other writings. And then there's Elisha. And under Elisha, you can see a man by the name of Obadiah. And John Whitcomb then is among those who's going to classify Obadiah as the earliest prophet. Okay. Now, if you were to go to that time, the time of Elijah, and let's just kind of go over there for just a real quick reference. If you go to the, in your Bibles, to the book of 1 Kings, and let's see, where do we want to put in here tonight? 1 Kings, towards the end of the book, and let's see. I wasn't going to do this, but I thought I'd show you this just so you can see this, because I...
Chapter 18.
Thank you, sweetheart. Oh, there it is. Hey, look at my Bible, even has a heading. If I just look at the heading there, mine says, Obadiah meets Elijah. How about that? But if you look in this context, it says in verse 1, now it came about after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah, notice this, now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. So even though he's working, he's over Ahab's household, he is one that fears Jehovah, which is a remarkable thing in Israel. Okay. Not only that, but if you would, verse 4, for it came about when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of Jehovah. Now remember, Jezebel's not an Israelitess. Okay. Jezebel's father is a Sidonian. They were west neighbors to Israel, right up on the Mediterranean coast. And her father was Sidonians, and they were Baal worshippers. And so she introduced Baal worship. She really promoted it heavily when she married Ahab, who was an Israelite king. And if you remember, when God sent Israel into the land, when he was going to give them the land, that's exactly what he warned of. Don't let your sons marry their women. And don't give your daughters to their sons. They will turn the hearts of your sons away from God and turn them to serve other gods. And that is exactly what happened. It happened to Solomon, and it happened with Ahab, although Ahab himself was an evil man to begin with. Jezebel was even worse, because Jezebel took it upon herself and destroyed the prophets of Jehovah. So all the prophets in the land that stood for Jehovah, she was killing them. But Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s. So he divided them up. So you got two groups of 50s. And he hid them in a cave and provided them bread and water. So Elijah wasn't the only prophet. There were 100 others that were saved by Obadiah. Okay. Now, the question is at this point, is this Obadiah the same Obadiah that we have that writes the book that we're going to be looking at? We don't know. Because it doesn't tell us anything. You can read about what he does in his interaction here with Elijah, and he's going, oh, great, I'm going to go tell Ahab that you're alive and you want to talk with him. He's going to kill me for even talking to you. Because he knows how angry Ahab really dislikes Elijah. He blames all of these problems on Elijah. Don't you like how people are irrational with the way they react to things? You know, things happen, and they don't see their culpability in the situation, do they? It just seems to escape them that they actually bear responsibility for their own problems. This was somebody else caused this. And people see that. And I see it around in the world all the day. In fact, just the other day, I was reading something in the news, or maybe it was yesterday morning, I was reading the news on the computer, and I'm reading there, and I was going, they were blaming this situation here, and I'm going, They're not at fault. You guys are at fault. You did it yourself, but you're blaming somebody else for your own problem, and they can't even see it, and they're suing somebody else. They're going, but that's exactly the way Ahab was. God brought famine on the land because of how evil the people were and how evil the king was. And he blames it on Elijah. Well, Elijah was the one that brought the news that God was doing it. That's what happened. Elijah was the bearer of bad tidings in that case. And Ahab didn't like that. Anyway, all that to say that we have an Obadiah here. Whether this is the same Obadiah, we don't know. But then this also, in part then, gives rise to a whole question about when was Obadiah written, which we're going to try to talk about maybe a little bit here this evening. And since we don't know, since it's not dated, we have three prophecies that aren't dated. Three, we have Obadiah, Joel, and Jonah. And none of them are dated. Now, when I say dated, the rest of the prophets tell you that he was writing in the days of, and they give you the names of the kings or the events that were going on. So you've got some real concrete historical events in time that you can hang things on. Kind of what Ben continues to remind you of downstairs when he's been going in that adult class on the fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies has been reminding you. But that's one of the most remarkable things about the Bible, is it's got so many historical statements in it. And those historical statements validate what it is because they have been demonstrated to be proof. Archaeology, they dug things up and they found archaeological demonstrations of the exact events that were recorded in Scripture. You didn't even know King David, probably one of the most famous kings of Israel's history, that up until the last century, scholars debated whether or not there ever was a real David. They kind of thought he was like a King Arthur figure, you know, kind of mythical. You know, maybe there was somebody sort of like that, but maybe not, because they didn't know. And they found, inscription on a thing in a place over there in Israel called Tel Dan, where there's an inscription about the household of David from the household of Jesse of Judah that they found. And they're like, wow, look at that, the actual inscription. We knew it. The Bible told us. We didn't need to dig up an inscription on a tablet to tell us that. But we have a lot of historical references. Now, you turn over to the book of Obadiah for a little bit. How many of you are going to have to sing the song now? Hosea. So you find Daniel, remember? Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. It's one chapter. We're looking at it first because we're taking these books. We're taking these books in chronological order, and the chronological order, let me throw this up here. Whoops, back up. Okay, this is your chronological order now, and we have the three that are undated, and then you can see the next ones down are the pre-exilic, and then the exilic, and then the what? Exilic. Oh, I don't have that on. I'm sitting here going, okay. Exilic means exile, okay? It's like when they talk about the letters of Paul, they don't call them Pauline letters. When John writes, it's Johannine writing, you know. This is exilic. So we're talking about, in this case, when this comes up, you can see how these prophets come out that we have, as we said, three undated. Now, there's approximate dates listed here that we have, but we have three that are undated. Then we have a series of prophets. I should have my...
It was a good fit. It's a good fit.
Okay. So we have... I don't know. This is really weird. It's not showing it the way my computer shows it. Okay, I'm going to quit it and see if I can start it up again. See if it'll do it.
While you're doing that, let me ask you this. I was trying to ask earlier. You said that Jezebel came from Sidonian. Were the Sidonians one of the peoples that Israel was supposed to eliminate when they got to the land? Or?
I don't know if I have a... Here's where Sidon was. Sidon was way up here on the north coast. So Israel was taking this land down in here, and Sidon was one of those places that wasn't designated yet. If they would have filled out all the way up here to this northern river as God had promised under Abraham, they eventually would have had to dispossess the Sidonians, but they didn't have, they hadn't reached that zenith yet. Okay, they hadn't gotten that big. And remember, the kingdom came to its largest under David. Okay, there was some a little bit of expansion under Solomon, but not by conquest, because Solomon wasn't a warrior. Okay, going back here then to this. We have these three that are undated, Obadiah, Joel, and Jonah. And then we have these, and this list includes Isaiah and Jeremiah, Lamentations, and Ezekiel. But these are pre-exilic. That is, they all are before the Babylonian exile. Okay, so that's why we say pre-exilic. Then we have two and a half that are in the exile, that are exilic. That is, Lamentations and the end of Jeremiah are written after the exile starts. If you remember, if you've ever read through Jeremiah, when you get to the end of Jeremiah, Jeremiah is one of the few that's left in the land after the rest of them are carried away. Tries by God's direction to encourage people, stay here in the land. God's promised that he'll protect us. And they all get scared. And they don't listen either. And they knock their knees and they run off to Egypt to try to get help. And then there's Ezekiel and Daniel, okay, that also are within the exile. And then there are three post-exilic prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So this kind of...
But Jonah, I thought it was just the next generation that it fell.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Jonah, he went and he warned them.
He went to Nineveh.
Or Nineveh.
So he had nothing to do with... He was from Israel, and because Nineveh was...
Yeah, but he warned them, and they didn't change their ways.
And Nineveh fell 100 years after, approximately 100 years after Jonah went there. So they repented, they staved off the destruction of Nineveh, and about 100 years later they went back. And another one of the prophets will deal with the destruction of Nineveh about 100 years later. Okay.
His timeline says 612.
Well, his timeline's not going to match all of these exactly. That's... I'm pulling these from some different sources, and I think that Whitcomb's not too bad, but I'm just pulling these from here. We'll deal with Jonah when we get to Jonah. I'm just trying to show you where Obadiah is, and it's probably our first prophet. But there are, and this is the other point, there are some prophets that put Obadiah as sometime after 586. Now, what happened in 586? No, 586 is the final deportation of Jews to Babylon. Daniel goes in about 606. The first, there were three deportations to Babylon. Daniel goes with the first when Nebuchadnezzar took the cream of the crop, and then there continued to be two more deportations after the one Daniel was in. And 586 is when the last one. 586 is the one in which Jerusalem was destroyed. Okay. That's the one where they went in and they just ransacked the city and just totally left it a pile of rubble. There's nothing left. The walls were torn down. The temple was torn down. That's what happened in 586. Now, the reason they say that is because this book, because it doesn't date itself, the events are either fulfilled by some events that we're going to look at tonight that either took place in the book of 2 Chronicles around chapter 21, or they took place sometime after 586 when Babylon sacked. Those are the two possible times. Those almost all scholars, let's just even put it this way, we didn't say scholars. Bible students that have studied, almost all Bible students would agree that it's either one date or the other. And I don't care what book you pick up on these things, if there are Bible believing people, they're going to hold to one of these two dates, and they're going to try to go through and demonstrate this is the reason why it's Babylon late. This is why it's an earlier situation. Okay. Now, that's all the perhaps boring stuff with regard to the date of the book, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Now, this book, if you're in Obadiah, and you look in verse 1, it says, "The vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom." Edom, if you look, is... right down here in this region. I'm going to pull up the next map because it'll actually list it as Edom down there. We have the, you can't even see it. Yeah, you can. Right up here it says Judah. J-U-D-A-H. It's just the bottom of the letters up there. But you can see here's Jerusalem. Okay? Here's Jerusalem, and then down here are the Edomites in this region down here. This is the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, and down here on the south is where the Edomites are. Now I'm going to go back here to the last one. And you can see, here's the Salt Sea, there's Jerusalem, and here's Petra, one of the main cities of the Edomites. It's not the main city, but it's one of the ones that is still surviving today that people go to see. This whole region in here, and I'm going to go back to this other map now, because this map gives you some perspective on the lay of the land. This land was all very high and mountainous. And that was one of the things that the Edomites were known for, was for people that lived in a high mountainous area. Now, you know what? I used to always think that doesn't mean a whole lot today, to live in high mountainous area, to live in cliffs and crags, because, you know, back in their day, that was a big deal. You could hold out inside a mountain like that, and if you had water sources and enough food, you could hang out there for a long time, because you can keep repelling the army. But we've got modern warfare. We drop over and we have bunker buster bombs that we drop from planes. Tell that to the troops trying to take the people out over in Afghanistan that are held up in mountains. They've been over there for years, and it's slow. And it just shows you, even in a place like that, even with the cases of modern warfare, without going to the extent of dropping an atomic bomb, which or a nuclear bomb, which nobody wants to think about doing anything that savage, that's about the only way to take people out when they're held up in mountainous regions. Why do you think you had all the nut jobs that wanted to go over and hold up in the mountains of North Idaho? Because it was the way that they thought to protect themselves and isolate themselves away from things that they weren't excited about. Okay. Now, they're not listed in this. We have another group right here, the Moabites on this side. They're all in the family now. Okay. In fact, I was telling my wife this months ago when I was first started kind of working on some of this material. Who are the Edomites?
Esau's descendants.
And Esau, whose brother?
Jacob.
Okay. Jacob. Now, who are the Midianites? They were.
Moses' family.
Okay. He was related, though, but they were actually, the Midianites, if I correctly, they were the ones that were related to Ishmael, were descended. But it's the Edomites that are descended from Esau. The Moabites, right in here, who were they descended from? Other families. Lot, okay, so they're descendants of Lot, the Moabites over here on the right side. So the Moabites, east side, I'm sorry, you're talking about map, it's east and west. Moabites, they were descendants of Lot, so they're relatives to Abraham. So you stop and think about some of the people in this land, how many of them in reality were related. Now the people that were in this land, all these different people here, the Jebusites, the Hittites, the Amorites, all of these different people that were settled into the land, they, on the other hand, were descendants from Ham, descendants from Canaan that settled in the land when they got off the ark. And that's who those people were when they went in and settled into those areas. And some of them went down into certain parts of North Africa and settled in parts of Egypt. So ultimately, we're all in the family. Some of them a little bit more closely when you go back to the time of the ark. But really, when you get in here, when you're talking about the Edomites and the Moabites, and then the children or the sons of Israel, when they come up here and cross the Jordan to come in the land, you're talking about people that are closer relatives now than just Noah and his three sons. Because you're talking about Abraham's nephew, Lot, and having a child through his daughter. And you're talking about, well, daughters, but a particular one. And then the Edomites down here, which then is a generation down, a couple generations down the road, because there's Abraham, Isaac, and Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau, and Jacob is the one that the blessing comes through, and Israel's going to come through, because Jacob's name will be changed to Jacob. He's no longer going to be the usurper, the heel grabber, he's going to be God's wrestler, God's strong one. And then you go the other way, and you have Esau, and Esau is the father then of the people of Edom. So that kind of gives you a perspective on, when you're thinking about this, you're dealing with family members. I want you to take your Bibles and turn to Genesis 25. Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, and if you look at verse 29, now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary, and Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that red stew. There it is, that Edom stew. See? That red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. Okay? So you actually have him because of that. Now, it's not just because of red stew. One of the things that was amazing, my wife was, when we were reading in Genesis back, I don't know, a couple months ago, when we were going through the Old Testament, my wife was commenting on how hairy this man was. Because remember, what did Jacob do to deceive his father? He put a goat skin on there. Okay, you wives, I don't care how hairy your husbands are, you cover his arm. Does that feel like a goat skin? That just shows you just what this man was like. And he was a man that was very rough and ruddy in appearance and extremely hairy. And he's a man of the field. He liked to run and hunt in the outdoors. Remember what Jacob's reputation was? Jacob was a man of tents. That's kind of like talking about a farmer boy versus a city boy. So Esau was a city boy, or as a farmer boy, hunter boy, and Jacob was a city boy. That was kind of the, you know, modern parallel to what the way we describe it. Mama's boy, too. Yes, mama's boy. What? 25, verse 30. Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same stew, that red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. There it is. And he becomes the father then of the Edomites. Now, turn with me over to the book of Numbers, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Turn to Numbers 20. Now, what's happening in the book of Numbers? What's the main storyline? Okay, that's part of it, but what's the other main storyline going on in Numbers? Numbers is the book that recounts what happens in Exodus. Exodus is the deliverance of Israel from Egypt and the building of the, deliverance from Egypt, Sinai giving of the law, and building of the tabernacle. Okay. Then you have Leviticus, which Leviticus is a technical book on what Levitical life was under the law, how the priests were to understand the law. Okay, sacrifices and what needed to be given in what situation. Then Numbers resumes the journey. In Numbers, the temple was finished in Exodus. Now in Numbers, the journey resumes and they head out. You have a big event that happens in Numbers. They get to Kadesh Barnea where they send in the spies. And the spies go, yeah, it's a great land, but we can't take it, you know. And so you have 10 of them that give the people a bad report. And you have a rebellion, and they go back, and thus begins the 40 years wandering while they're traveling about there. And then eventually, the book of Numbers then covers the space of time in which everybody dies, that's 20 years and older and upwards, that had rebelled, and then God begins to take those people then up around this way, and he's going to take them the long way, and he's going to bring them across this. Now, they could have taken a different route through here, but it didn't happen. And if you look here in Numbers, chapter 20, Numbers chapter 20, if you look with me at verse 20, and then he said, let's go to verse 18. No, I want to go back up to verse 14. I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure out where is a good place to put in. I should always decide these things ahead of time. Because, you know, when I'm studying, I pick the key verses and I write those down. And I always think there's a bigger context that's helpful. So sorry about that. Verse 14. Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel. Now notice that. Your brother Israel. Because Edom was Israel's brother. Edom was Esau's name. Israel was Jacob's brother. Was Jacob's name. Jacob, you know, Jacob. They didn't really have a J in Hebrew. And says, thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt. We dwelt in Egypt a long time. The Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers, and we cried out to the Lord. He heard our voice and sent the angel and brought us up out of Egypt. Now, here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through your fields. or vineyards, nor will we drink water from wells. We will go, and think about this, this is a sizable group of people that's traveling through here. If they started eating from your fields and from your vineyards and started drinking out of your wells, they could drain a well dry, just about, with all the people. Because I can't imagine what it must have been like for the people to have water. You can see why God divinely had to supply them water. That's a lot of people. You know, you got one little pump spigot like that. If everybody had to come get water out of a pump spigot every day, not everybody even get a mouthful. You wouldn't have a chance for everybody to come get a mouthful out of that in a day with all the people that were trudging through here. So we're not going to do any of that. We won't touch any of those things. But we will go along the king's highway. So this is why they wanted to travel. There was a good, well-traveled route that would have taken them through here. We will not, and the reason I want to say there was a well-traveled route, I brought this up because if you look here, see there was a main trade route that ran through here. And that's one of the things that made Edom a real key area, is because they had this valley that came in here, and this was a major travel route for trade. See? You're here in America, what? If they shut down your interstates or they shut down your railroads, you'd be really, what would you do? You depend on them for them to ship stuff to you and for you to ship stuff to people. And shipping was just as important back then as it was. They may not have hauled it in a semi or in a freight car, but they still hauled it. They hauled it in what they called them. They actually called them ships of camels. I always thought that was a funny thing to look at camels as ships, but that's the way they looked at them out there. And they would send those long, long lines through the desert. In fact, remember, that's how Joseph got sold. Because what were they? They were Midianites. They were traders that were traveling. And it was a huge bunch of them. It wasn't 10 guys. We're talking about a massive caravan of traders. You understand why, just as an aside, you understand why you had huge caravans that traveled like that. Because you had marauding bands that were always looking for the stupid trader that there's he and his brother and their uncle that are traveling through the country. And you steal everything they've got on their 10 camels. You know, you make off with it. So you traveled in packs that could defend yourselves against. Aren't you glad you don't have to do that when you take a trip cross country? Anyway, I could tell that. We might need to tell the story about the lady on Car Talk. Yes. That was just. I told Gary a little bit about it already. Gary got a little bit of a chuckle out of it, too. Anyway, Exodus chapter 20. Sorry to get. Or Numbers, I'm sorry, Numbers 20. We haven't got where we're at. I got distracted, I'm sorry. So we're going to pass through there. Verse 18, and Edom said to him, "You shall not pass through, lest I come out against you with a sword." So the son, literally, the sons of Israel said to him, "We will go by the highway. And if I or my livestock drink any water, then I will pay for it. Let me only pass through on foot. Nothing more." That's it. And he said, "You will not pass through." So Edom came out against them with many men, and with a strong hand, and thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. So they had to take a more circuitous route on their journey on towards the land of Israel, the land that God's going to give them, because Edom, their brother, wouldn't let him pass through. Now turn over to Deuteronomy, the next book.
So where is
Israel? Oh, and the next thing? Journeyed from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor, which I don't know if we can see it on here. Because Kadesh is, I don't know if Kadesh is on this map. Because Kadesh should be down in here. So they're actually, the problem is all this stuff is down south here of where we're at this point. This map I don't think comes up far enough. What? Kadesh?
No.
Oh, Mount Hor?
So that valley right there. Where the highway was, so they had to go outside of the.
Yeah, so now they've got rough travel where they got to travel all the way out and around all of this stuff over here. Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is being in places like this, even though the salt sea is dry, being in here is going to be better than being way out here in the wide open. And you understand, in terms of just ease of travel and things like that. Okay, Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy chapter 23. Now, if you remember, always remember what Deuteronomy is. Deuteronomy is now the next generation. Mom, dad, aunts and uncles, grandma and grandpas have all died in the wilderness and their corpses fell dead. Now you've got the next generation. They're standing essentially on the east side of the Jordan. They're getting ready to cross over. And God is having Moses rehearse the law the second time. Thus we have the word Deuter to Deuteronomy, second law. So it's the second giving of the law. But it's really giving it to the next generation, okay? Or the 20 and under generation, with the exception of Caleb and Joshua. And one of the instructions that God gave them, if you look at verses 7 and 8, is he's going through and reminding, and he adds, this is something he adds, wasn't given initially in the law, you shall not hold them as something very horrible, an Edomite, for he is your brother. Shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you are an alien in his land. The sons of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. In other words, after three generations, for apparently meaning for what they had done to you when you've just come out, after three generations have passed, they can actually be allowed to come in and join with the people of Israel. They'd have to be circumcised and learn to keep the law, but they could then actually come and participate within the events and things that were going on in the nation of Israel. So that's a little bit of a background, very briefly, on who the Edomites were and what Israel's relationship was to them. And the importance of verses 7 and 8 is that God had warned Israel in the law, you're not supposed to stir up trouble with Edom. You're not supposed to treat them as an enemy. You're not supposed to abhor them. Regardless of how they may have treated you and they didn't let you pass through on the king's highway and go through their land, you don't have to do that back to them. Which, by the way, is a good lesson to learn, isn't it? I mean, that's one of the things you try to teach your kids when they're little, right? It's just because your sister hit you, you don't hit your sister back.
Two wrongs will make a right.
That's right, you know. Things aren't solved by, you know. Now, I want you to, with some of this, I want you to go back then for a little more background on what we're going to see in Obadiah. I want you to go back to Genesis, but I want you to go to Genesis 12. Genesis chapter 12. Can anybody tell me what's the main theme that goes on in Genesis 12? The promise, or in other terms, the... No. Oh, don't say that. This is not the Abrahamic covenant. This is a promise and it's a call of Abraham, but this is not the covenant. God does not make a covenant with Abraham until Genesis 15. This is not the covenant. I don't care what your Scofield Bible says. I don't care what Ryrie says. There's no covenant made here. Okay? They all say this is Abrahamic covenant, but it's not. It's a promise. Please. Okay. This is a promise. The covenant is going to be made in Genesis 15, and God will make, remember, four covenants before he's done with Abraham. One in Genesis 15, two in Genesis 17, and one in Genesis 22. They're similar. A covenant is a contractual promise. It was a promise that was made when you slew animals, and it was like signing paper. It's not like a person saying, I promise to come by and give you this tomorrow, or I promise that I'm going to help you with this. It's like signing your name on a paper when you say, I promise to buy this house, or I promise to buy this car. That was closer to what a covenant was. So a covenant was a very serious promise. God doesn't, and by the way, does God have to make a covenant or swear a covenant to make a promise? No. So does God make promises to us? Are they all in the form of a covenant? No. A lot of the promises he's made to us are not in the form of a covenant. What? Pardon me?
You don't need a covenant.
Yeah. Can anybody tell me a book that tells you you don't need to swear an oath, you don't need a covenant for making a promise? Hebrews chapter. Yeah. Hebrews chapter 6, the end of the chapter, the writer of Hebrews, who's Paul, says over there. Yeah, says that's what man does. Man swears by something higher than himself. God can't do that because there's nothing higher than God. So God said, I myself swear. I'm going to make this. And he made a covenant with Abraham. That's Genesis 22 covenant, by the way, that he's talking about. But his point, when he says that in Hebrews chapter 6, is God didn't even have to do that. Because the immutable thing is God said it. If God just says, I'm going to do it, that's all he needs. Does he need to sign his name? Does he need to make a covenant? Does he need to swear? If God says, I'm going to do it, that's all you need. So even though Genesis 12 is not a covenant, it is a promise, and it is good as done, even though it's not given as a covenant. Now the importance, I'm going to say this, this is the importance of, and this is why I'm making a big deal, because I don't want you people to feel bad that it's like, no, don't make it a covenant. The reason I say that is, because a lot of dispensationalists come over here and they say, this is the Abrahamic covenant. Then what do you do with Genesis 15? The two covenants in Genesis 17 and the covenant in Genesis 22. They make those additions and they start adding those to this, which violates what Paul says in Galatians 3, that once you make a covenant, you don't add to it and you don't disannul it. Which, aren't you glad that that's the case? Aren't you glad that when you decide you're going to buy a car or buy a, let's use a house. Because some of you might, when you buy a car, you might pay cash and it's all over with. But if, when you buy a house, very few people pay cash for a house and it's over with. Most of you have a mortgage when you buy a house. So you're making payments. Aren't you glad that your bank doesn't come along a year or two down the road saying, oh, this is what we signed for, but we're changing the terms of the mortgage contract. You're going to owe us this much now. See, unless they gave you, what do you call it, an adjustable rate mortgage or something, unless you sign one of those thinking that'll be in my favor, not thinking it would ever be against you, you know, unless you did something like that, they can't change the terms of the contract. Not unless you and they both agree to it. See? Of course, it works both ways. And of course, consumers sometimes fail to realize that they are supposed to hold up their end of the bargain, but that's a whole other consumer lesson. And we're not here to teach economics. So, chapter 12, verse 1. Sorry. The Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. By the way, this word bless is very much like the New Testament word to say something good about. We have two words for bless in the New Testament. We have the word bless, which means to make happy, and the word bless, which means to speak well of. This word bless, the Hebrew word barak, meant you said a good thing about. But what he said when he says, I'm saying a good thing about you, is I'm saying it's good because I'm going to do good things for you. That's the way a Jew understood it. In other words, when you said barak, it was almost like saying, I'm promising to do good stuff for you. So that's a blessing. And it's what you're promising. It's what you're saying. Okay. So he goes on, I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Not only am I going to bless you, but you're going to be a blessing. That is, people are going to say good things about you, and you will be one that will actually cause this kind of prosperity or this kind of benefit for others. Verse 3, I will bless those then who bless you. In other words, those that prosper you, I prosper them. Those who, on the other hand, curse you. Does that just mean that they say bad things about him? I actually think it goes a little further than that. Probably involves that they actually act towards that. It's not like, what's her name? I can't think of her name. Lady that just got fired from, Helen Thomas. Oldest press journalist at the White House. And remember a couple weeks ago? There's something came up with Israel, and she said they ought to get the beep out of the land. They said is they ought to get out of there. They said, where are they supposed to go? Tell them to go home. She goes, what's their home? Well, they all came from Poland. Poland and Germany. See, that's her perspective on the land of Israel, which is showing you a person that's supposed to be an educated journalist how, I mean, there were a lot that came from there, but that's not where they all came from. It shows you how ignorant she was of things. But anyway, that type of mentality, there'd be a question. I'm sure we'd have some friends that would say the very fact that she said that, she's cursing them. Well, if she had her way, she'd be able to encourage people to enforce that, but she's just a journalist, although doesn't the pen have an awful lot of power sometimes in persuading people's minds? But I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all families of the earth then shall be blessed. Now, the significance of this is if you go back to Obadiah, and we're just going to introduce a little piece here, and then we'll finish off tonight. But Obadiah If you get to Jonah, you've gone too far, because it's right before Jonah. But Obadiah, verse 1, it says, the vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We've looked at who they were. Who we have heard a report from the Lord. A messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, arise, let us rise up against her for battle. Behold, I will make you, now referring to Edom, small among the nations. You shall be greatly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, for you dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is like. We looked at the map. We kind of showed you what that ground is like. Who says in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground, though you ascend as high as the eagle? Now there's almost a little bit when he brings that out, most commentators kind of look at that it's not just that an eagle has an elevated status, but what's an eagle do with an elevated status? What is an eagle by definition? It's a bird of prey, which is exactly the type of thing that these Edomites had done. So they boasted their elevated status to be able to be high. So they gave them a vantage point and elevated above everybody else, but then be able to swoop in. And though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. Now there's a number of other things that are in there, which we're going to save for when we come back. But I want you to flip over in here to verse 12. Well, to verse 10, excuse me. It says, for violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. In the day that, and by the way, if you haven't done this, I would encourage you to read through Obadiah in here. But I did this with two colored pens. You get those pens from Sasha, two different colors, and I marked some different things in here. And it's very helpful, especially in this section here, to mark in the day, in the day, in the day, in the day, because there's just like a poetic listing. So that's one of the other things. See, if you and I were, if somebody asked you to give a prophecy today, and you were to make one up, I'm not saying God gave you and you were to make a prophecy up, you wouldn't do it like these Hebrew did. You'd be surprised. A lot of these Hebrew prophets, you know what they did? They prophesied poetry. And they had rhymes, and they had repeated phrases. So you have in the day, in the day, in the day. And then you have in the next phrase, you keep having these al, 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 which is not, not, not. So it's, if you go through these now, verse 11, in the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, even you were one of them. That is, you were among those who were doing these things. But you, this, and that, by the way, is one of the reasons that they don't think this was this referred to the Babylonian captivity, because there isn't a lot of historical emphasis on Edom playing a role in what happened in Babylon. This seems to be an earlier event, which we'll come back and talk about next week as we start moving through this. But verse 12, you should not have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity. Nor, say, now you have a nor in my Bible. Now, by the way, I'm going to do something here. Because I've been doing this out of the Hebrew, and I went through and I translated all this for myself. And so that's the way I understood it. But then I was reading a commentary, and the commentary looked at all this. All this is a warning of what's going to happen. So I want you to see, if you have a New American Standard, yours isn't reading like mine, is it?
It says on the day, but then you're talking about in Obadiah we just read?
Yeah, just a second. I just want to read this the way it reads in the New American Standard, because the New American Standard is going to read these down. Verse 12, New King James, they say, but you should not have gazed on the day of your brother. 12 in the New American Standard, do not gloat over your brother's day. Then you go down and say, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah. And it says in here, nor should you have rejoiced over the sons of Judah. In other words, the New King James is taking all of these things as past tense. The New American Standard is translating all these things as though they're yet to come, and don't do them. Okay? Now, that reflects some theology. And the reason I say it reflects some theology is because all of these verbs in this section, and when we go through this, we'll explain it in more detail, but all of these verbs are in the Hebrew, what we call imperfects. So they're all talking about, and an imperfect can refer to something in the past. It can do that, because they're not tenses like we think of tenses. But the imperfect normally is looking at something that's beginning or going to go on. And so the imperfect, the way the New American Standard words it, to some degree, really does reflect a little bit more of the idea that is going to come about here. And so, but there's a debate then. It has the debate then. How it's a question we'll have to deal with it. But is this how Edom did treat them, or is it a warning not to treat them like this? And while the New American Standard seems to reflect the Hebrew, the natural flow of the Hebrew, but the Hebrew doesn't demand it. The New King James, to be honest, reflects more the fact that, yeah, this is why you guys are getting it in the neck. I'm not warning you not to do something. I'm telling you, you did it, and this is why you're getting it. You did this, 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 and that's what we're going to see. And what does that go back to that we looked at in Genesis 12? What? Well, and that's a possibility. That's one of the things that some of them try to handle in here, because they see that they look at it as a warning against future activities, but somewhere along the line, you kind of have to make a choice on what is God referring to. Is he referring to something they've done, or is he referring to something they're about to do, or maybe will do in the future? We'll come back and deal with that a little bit more, but here's the point. Whether this is something they're about to do or whether they have done it, we do know that according to verse 10, they did act with violence against Jacob. That's already an established fact. Now it's going to be a question as we look through here about whether they're going to start doing more violence or whether all of that is something that we've done in the past. What does that have to do with the Genesis 12 passage we were looking at? God? Oh, curse those who curse you. Those who acted with violence. And that's what the book of Obadiah is about. The book of Obadiah, this short one chapter book, is all about God's judgment on Edom for their treatment of Jerusalem and Judah specifically, in a specific situation in which Jerusalem, at least, was ransacked. And we're going to come back and we'll develop this a little bit more later. But that's what it's about. Now, when you stop and you read those things, we're not Israel. And we're not Judah. We all know that. So is there any benefit for you and I to study a minor prophet such as Obadiah? Okay. What purpose does it serve? When he makes a promise, he means it. And that's one of the things that's encouraging. And it's also an encouragement in that regard, to remind us that when God says, I'm doing something with these people and I have plans for the way you handle them, God takes that seriously. Now, we're not looking there as part of our study tonight, but I just, if you want a parallel to that, I don't want to spend all our time always drawing parallels, but I just kind of feel somewhat compelled to try to encourage you, even though we're looking in Old Testament text here, encourage you. You know, Paul says this in 2 Thessalonians 1, doesn't he? It is natural for you as a Christian. I was talking with this gentleman the other day that doesn't think that the church will be raptured before the tribulation. Doesn't think that. But this is one of the things he told me when he was talking. He says one of his biggest problems, aside from the fact that Jesus doesn't talk about it, and I tried to tell him, well, Jesus wasn't talking about the rapture, but that was another thing. He says his biggest problem with this is, he says, it seems like all the Christians that believe in the preacher of rapture, they use it to just say, our life's going to be easy. God's going to give us an easy life. In other words, we teach this so that we're telling our people, life's going to be hunky-dory. Everything's going to go well for you. Nothing that bad's ever going to happen, because God's going to protect us from all that, because we don't go through this. And I said, you know what? I agree with you. I'm not saying that all those people are guilty of, but I said, that's a lot of that goes on in Christendom. And I said, personally, I think that goes on in Christendom, even among people that don't believe in a creature of rapture in some way. I think people kind of have a strained view of how God relates to us as members of the church. God's never promised us protection from harm. In fact, it's the Apostle Paul that told us, if you choose to live godly, you're going to suffer persecution. It's going to happen. You look at the early church, they all suffered hardship. Which of the disciples wasn't martyred? How many of the early Christians were put to death? And down through the centuries it has been that way. We've known relative peace as believers for 500 years, roughly, out of the history of the church, maybe 600.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why some of the people, whether they were true Christians or not, or we don't, that's some of the reasons that they came, remember, to America. I was trying to look for religious freedom. But even over here, now we're in a situation where we have that. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not trying to be a doomsayer, but it's time to cheer me about this. I'm telling Peg this for years. I'd be surprised if in my life we don't see a radical change in the attitude of our country towards Christians, and a radical change to the point that your life won't be the same as it is now. I really hope that's not the case.
Well, they're starting that in schools. Kids are growing up with that.
With that idea, yeah. But I think I would be negligent as a pastor if I didn't do exactly what Paul said and warn you. You're going to suffer persecutions. If I told you that if you do all these things in the Christian life, you'll be prosperous, your business will be rich, your kids will all be healthy, I'd be teaching you law of prosperity gospel. God hasn't promised you any of that. You might do all the right things and all the kids might get sick, except for the two that are the carriers. Just kidding. I mean, it sometimes happens, you know. The point being is that there is an encouragement for you that God does say that you're going to go through difficulties. But the encouragement in 2 Thessalonians 2 is that when you go through the difficulties, that the people that bring the difficulties, there is a price they will pay for doing that one day. 2 Thessalonians 1, not 2. 2 Thessalonians 1 is very clear on that. It's not the only place. But it is something to keep in mind. And I agree with that. And he was kind of surprised. He was surprised to find somebody that believes in the preacher of rapture that thinks, yeah, the church could go through hard times. You know, in this life. You know, that might be one of the reasons we'll really like the rapture, because times have been so hard at a given time. I don't know. So I don't know what it'll be like immediately coming before Paul told us. We've given enough examples of what life is going to be like as the church has gone on. Those things have been true throughout the 2,000 years of the church's history, and there have been ups and downs. But just as God made a promise to Abraham to bless those that are blessed, I'm a curse those that are cursed. In a very similar way, God has promised a certain retribution on people for the way they handle his saints today also. It may not be as severe as what God may not be in exact the same way that God's going to do it with regard to the nation of Israel, but there are similarities. Okay. We haven't taken over their promises, mind you. I'm not saying that. So, okay. Anyway, quick question at the end here.
So the promise God made to Abraham, like you're kind of alluding to this journal that can for saying bad things about Israel. Now, so explain to me, we know that Israel is kind of on hold as far as what God's doing with Israel and the law, but does that promise still valid? So, like, let's say you get these wacko, what's his name, Hussein, Iranian president, you know, who's always talking about, wiping off Israel off the map. So, if this promise is true, and we know God's promises are true, but if it's today, it's also going to be carried out. That means at some point he's going to get wiped out. I mean, this nation.
God, let's put it this way. In the present time, God is not working with Israel as a specific nation. He is working with the church. But he has made promises to Israel that have not been negated. And I think that there is some legitimacy to that promise in the fact that God is continuing to maintain their existence. And I'm not saying the existence of that nation over there. I personally, in my faith, I'm so confident in what God could do that present nation could be wiped off the map as it exists. And God could totally reestablish them next year, if that's what God wanted to do to start the tribulation period. So I don't think God, but the Israelites as a people will not be wiped out, and God will continue to protect them. And when people go after them, they pay the price. They do it at their own expense. They think it's okay to be hostile to somebody. It's like we're talking about people that don't, the whole thing about consequences, we were saying that earlier, that people don't realize their responsibility for what they're doing. It's like those Palestinians keep lobbing those things on a regular basis, and then we feel sorry for them when Israel tries to stop tries to have a blockade and keep things getting in there. And you never hear, you hardly ever hear anybody ever talk about why Israel does this. Mm-hmm. You know, I heard the other day, well, there is daily, you know, shells are being lobbed over there, these missiles, these little things, but they're so ineffective, it's not really, Israel shouldn't get uptight about it. That's like saying, my neighbors shoot 22s, they're not 45s, so I ought to just put up with it, you know. I'm sorry. I just kind of think it's kind of stupid, but.
It would be like Palestinians on, yeah, it's only 9 miles, I think it's 9 miles.
That's the shortest part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think people. Yeah.
I mean, if you told if the Canadians were shooting guns in FX, do you think Americans would sit back and go, oh well, it's just a little bad.
Yeah. Anyway. So anyway, well, we'll come back and I think probably, I'm kind of thinking it might take us a couple of weeks to go through some of the things that are in Obadiah and kind of develop some of the specifics a little bit more, and then we'll move on into Joel. So let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we're thankful for the evening and for your word, all of it, even those parts that may not directly address us and our lifestyle, such as a prophet like Obadiah. Somewhat obscure, a lot of people really have no concept of what's going on in the book, but we realize even in there we see your keeping the promise that you made to Israel, that you would protect them and that you ultimately would cause those people who cursed them, those people that came out against them, to pay the price. And that's what's what you were promising, what you were prophesying to Obadiah, to this nation and the things that they were experiencing. And help us to appreciate then also for us, your plans for us, that you haven't promised to keep us from ever having any hardships or pain or going through difficulties. But you have also given us comfort that those who cause those problems, that there is a price that they will pay for choosing to really oppose what you're doing down here on this planet still, much like they were opposing what you were doing with Israel at that time. Thankful for the evening and those that you've brought out. Thank you for your word. Thankful always for your faithfulness. Amen.